From Pacifico Radio, this is Democracy Now! A man on death row gets a reprieve from the U.S. Supreme Court, some credit an international grassroots campaign against the death penalty. Poverty profiteers, as welfare contracts go to the states, Lockheed Martin and Ross Perot have their eyes on the prize. And politics online.
Another myth that's out there is that net users somehow represent a unique group of people from a political standpoint, that their views are out on the fringe, that they are in some ways, in some important ways, truly weird compared to the general population. And although that may be the case in some ways, it's not really in terms of their political views.
All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Kofi Annan is urging members of the United Nations to embrace change in the coming years. The UN General Assembly acclaimed Annan the next Secretary General yesterday. The 58-year-old diplomat from Ghana takes office January 1st. Annan told Assembly members the UN should see change as an ally and an opportunity. He says he'll stress what the UN can do to make life better for the majority of the world's people. Meanwhile, Secretary General Boutros Boutros-Ghali, in a thinly veiled jab at the United States, said yesterday the world body's financial crisis was caused by deadbeats and not by mismanagement. The Clinton administration blocked his bid for a second five-year term against the wishes of nearly all other UN members, saying he was sluggish in promoting reform. The 74-year-old former deputy prime minister of Egypt, law professor and author, alienated the Republican-dominated U.S. Congress, which refused to pay $1.3 billion in UN arrears. A senior State Department official says the administration is putting a plan together to pay off the $1 billion in outstanding UN dues. Princeton Lyman acknowledges the U.S. failure to pay has resulted in resentment among other nations. Lyman says the U.S. recognizes its obligation. He also warned if the problem isn't resolved soon, it will become very difficult to muster support in the world body. And this news from Chechnya. The Red Cross has evacuated most of its staff in Chechnya after six aid workers were shot and killed yesterday. Speculation on what prompted the attack ranges from an attempt to wreck the fragile peace in Chechnya to an effort to discredit separatists who are now in charge. Caribbean leaders, stung by U.S. accusations that they're dragging their feet in the war against drugs, vowed they would not bow to threats and coercion by Washington. Eight government heads meeting in Bridgetown on Monday on the dispute with the United States over drugs policy said the fight against narcotics was critically important but should be based on cooperation and mutually acceptable treaties. They rejected any suggestions or threat of coercive measures as a means of extracting compliance with predetermined policies. That meeting in Barbados. Israeli officials shrugged off the suddenly tougher stance against settlements President Clinton displayed this week, saying they intended to continue bolstering Jewish presence in Palestinian areas. Meanwhile, Secretary of State Christopher issued a gloomy assessment of prospects for a Hebron Accord, signaling growing U.S. impatience. And the dictator of Zaire has returned. Mobutu Sese Seko has returned and vowed to defeat a rebellion in the east. The president, who's ruled the Central African nation since 1965 with the support of the United States, left his villa on the French Riviera to return to Kinshasa, the capital where he has spent less than a day in the past 2 years. Well, I bet you didn't know that NASA has a left wing. Well, they didn't know either until two large chunks of Challenger's left wing that washed ashore will be buried early next year with some 5,000 other pieces of the exploded space shuttle. The fragments are believed to be the biggest pieces of Challenger discovered since NASA closed the investigation into the accident in 1986. This news also from Florida. An entertainer has reached a settlement with a cruise line and an employment agency after losing a job offer when a blood test turned up positive for the AIDS virus. The $90,000 settlement is the first case of its kind. The award comes in the first HIV employment case filed by the EEOC under the Americans with Disabilities Act. Slavery in 1996? Abolitionist groups say believe it. They're urging the U.S. government to take action to end the practice in northern Africa and the Persian Gulf area. The International Coalition Against Chattel Slavery says it's a common problem in many Arab countries, and the research director of the Boston-based American Anti-Slavery Group says Libya imports slave children from Sudan. New Jersey Congressmember Christopher Smith sponsored a provision in foreign aid law barring aid to Mauritania until President Clinton certifies its government has ended slavery. He says Sudan is his next big target. And the apparent loser in the election to head the Teamsters Union is asking for an investigation. The son of labor legend Jimmy Hoffa is asking a federal prosecutor to seize the ballots and look into alleged irregularities. James Hoffa's attorney says the election's federally appointed overseer failed to account for thousands of ballots. The allegation is based on a discrepancy between an estimate by postal authorities of ballots returned and the number of votes actually counted. Incumbent Teamsters President Ron Carey declared victory Saturday in a close race, but Hoffa isn't giving up. Carey supporters say they're sure the challenge ballots won't hold enough Hoffa votes to overcome the margin of victory from the first count. And you're listening to Democracy Now! As states around the United States implement welfare reform initiatives, it's not surprising that corporations are strategizing to make money off of these changes. But there's a twist. One of the companies going for the gold is Lockheed Martin, this country's largest defense contractor, at least one of them. We're now joined by Mark Dunley. He's executive director of the Hunger Action Network in New York and author of a piece in the latest edition of Covert Action Quarterly called The Poverty Profiteers Privatize Welfare. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Mark.
Good morning, Amy.
So tell us, what is happening now that these welfare contracts are going to the states?
Well, we're talking about a multi-billion dollar industry is being created. We already had seen some private companies like EDS, which is the company that Ross Perot had started, Maximus and America Works, moving in to take over part of the welfare system. But now we're starting to see Fortune 500 companies because the amount of money is quite large. And Lockheed has been one of the more notable ones as the defense contract industry begins to change. They're scrambling for more revenue, IBM, and some of the other big Fortune 500 companies are moving in.
Ross Perot, another name.
Well, Ross Perot has been in there for a while. Ross Perot built his fortune off of the welfare system, one of the first welfare pimps. Basically, he has sold computer systems during the 70s and the 80s to run Medicare and Medicaid systems. He eventually sold his company to IBM, but EDS, which was his company, was the pioneer of this whole fingerprinting of welfare participants. And we, of course, believe that the fingerprinting of welfare participants, besides all the problems with that as a policy, really is being used to develop the technology for expanded commercial applications, such as rental companies and bank cards. Basically, we're using poor people as guinea pigs. Once we develop the technology by denying poor people welfare benefits, then we're going to move into the broader commercial applications with the fingerprinting technology.
I know in New York State, when the governor decided to go with this fingerprinting policy where welfare applicants had to be fingerprinted, they said they were going to go after the welfare queens. They spent millions and millions of dollars, and I think they turned up less than half a dozen.
Well, I think statewide they now believe they may have found 50 people.
Oh, 50.
But they haven't proven that yet. But at the same time, they claim they have knocked off hundreds of thousands of people, mainly because sometimes when they send out notices for people to be fingerprinted, people don't turn up, and they claim that as savings. What they don't tell you is that any notice they send out, whether it's to come in to win the lottery, actually produces a higher rate of non-response than the fingerprinting request, and yet they just claim that as complete proof that fingerprinting is making a difference.
Well, this is quite a point you're making, the idea of the poor being used as guinea pigs to develop fingerprinting technology, and then it is used on everyone else. Well, let's talk about Lockheed Martin, and Lockheed Martin being the gatekeeper for welfare in the states, Lockheed Martin among other companies. It also looks like these corporations are now buying up officials around the country, welfare officials.
Well, that's a traditional way of how you get government contracts. You find somebody who has been previously working for the government agency that's going to award the contract and make the decision, and you basically give them a golden parachute, bring them on, and give them a nice little title like executive vice president, and their job is to lobby their, you know, former colleagues in order to get positions, to get the contracts, particularly Maximus, which has been one of the largest companies to date.
What is Maximus?
Maximus is just one of the – gotten several hundred million dollars worth of contracts around the country to manage these various welfare programs for the states. They have been found to have illegally rigged the contract process in West Virginia. They've hired former staff people for the United States Department of Health, Education, and Welfare to work for them to help them with the contract process. And when they go into a state, they'll look for a particular, what state official can we hire in order to grease the wheels for us? And not just Maximus, all these companies are starting to do that.
Another person you point out who has stepped through the revolving door is Gerald Miller, former director of Michigan's welfare program. He's now become Lockheed's new head of welfare initiatives.
Correct.
And I like the quote you have of him: the private sector will ultimately run these programs. The era of big government is over.
Well, I mean, that's what big business has been trying to do. They want to go from the era of big government to the era of big business. We're very concerned that, especially when you allow these companies to perform the gatekeeper role, getting to decide who actually gets benefits, their profits increase when they have fewer people obtaining services. And we think that, the welfare system, and remember, we're primarily talking about children here, even though the government always wants to talk about the adults. Two-thirds of welfare recipients are children. There is a built-in conflict of interest when you increase profits for a private company if they deny benefits for children and other people. And I think that's probably the most frightening part of this new wave with the federal repeal of the welfare system, is that now these private companies are going to be allowed to determine who gets benefits. And we've already seen that with the HMOs and the medical care system, where increasingly you have to be a very aggressive advocate in order to get any health care services. And now you're going to see the same type of approach being taken to the welfare system.
Now, how exactly will these corporations, one of the largest in the world military contractors, Lockheed Martin, decide whether this woman and her daughter get welfare?
Well, that's a good question, because we haven't seen that yet. Our suspicion will be it will be some type of computer program, and it gets, pointed in. It will, some will depend upon what rules the state provides. In fact, they may give them a lot of discretion, saying only give it to people who are really needy. What we're already seeing in New York State with the public sector running it is a lot of discretion at the local level, and they put people through a lot of hoops. And it just, the more hoops you make people jump through, the more likely they are to fall and stumble and not get into the system.
Well, I've got a novel idea. If you've got the military contractors deciding who gets welfare, maybe we can have welfare mothers deciding which military contractors get corporate welfare.
Well, we would think that would be a good idea, but not sure that's going to come about in the near future.
So who is going to decide which of these corporations, from Unisys to IBM to Anderson Consulting, the billion-dollar sister company of Arthur Anderson, who is going to decide which of these corporations get the state contracts?
Well, these will be elected officials making that decision. In many cases, they're going to be people who, for some reason, are going to receive a lot more campaign contributions from these companies. I mean, during the earlier part of the century, there's a reason why we went to a more professional public service system to run these programs, was because of political corruption. Bribery, sweetheart deals, revolving door contracts. They're going to be lobbying governors and state legislatures, and you're going to suddenly see a surge in campaign contributions to the officials that chair the committees that have the power to make these determinations.
We're talking to Mark Dunley. He's got one of the pieces in this month's Covert Action Quarterly, and it's about welfare. The poverty profiteers privatize welfare, one of the biggest corporate grabs in history. And one of the things you talk about at the end of your piece is workfare or slave labor. What do you mean?
Well, workfare is when the governor and the president talk about welfare to work, they're not really talking about real jobs for people. They're really talking about placing people in make work, usually at a government agency, sweeping floors, cleaning up the parks. And one of the real problems with that is that it's not very good in terms of moving people into real jobs. Already in New York City and in many parts of the state and now nationwide, people are being required to participate in these make-work positions at less than a minimum wage. And basically what we're doing is creating a subclass of workers who don't have any of the job protections, no grievance rights. They can be put into very unsafe conditions. Like here in New York City, they've been put into parks applying pesticides without the type of equipment and training that other people have. And this is a real threat. And now with the new federal welfare repeal, we can put workfare into the private sector, into McDonald's, into Burger King's, into home health care centers. And it's going to really drive down wages for a lot of other workers.
Years ago, I co-wrote a piece in the Progressive magazine about a thermometer company in Brooklyn that's no longer around. It's called the PIM Thermometer Company. People may have those PIM thermometers still. The heads of it actually were convicted of assault with a deadly weapon, and that weapon was mercury because of the deadly exposure of mercury that the workers had in the plants, and they were mainly African-American and Latino women. Well, interestingly enough, part of that workforce came from workfare, women who were forced to go to this place to work if they wanted to continue their welfare benefits. And the problem was, you might say, well, they're always free to say they don't want to work in this place, and that's what workfare people in charge of workfare say. But they were afraid that they would lose their benefits if they kept saying no. And so they were forced into this very dangerous place.
Well, they don't have a right to say no any longer. And in New York State, only 8% of the people who participate in workfare are actually eventually moved into a job. Three times as many people lose their benefits for alleged violation of workfare rules. Workfare is much more effective as a sanctioning tool, basically knocking people off of receiving assistance, than it is any type of job, you know, placement type stuff. Plus, it's now going to be a source of free labor, you know, for corporations, because the private sector can now take it. In New York City, the Transit Workers Union had a big fight with Mayor Giuliani to say that they could not put the workfare participants down on the subway lines themselves near the third rail where you can get electrocuted. And one of the things that the unions are saying is that you're placing people into hazardous work conditions, which if the union guys were doing it, we get bonus pay. Not only are you not giving them bonus pay for doing the hazardous work, but you're not even giving them the training they need, you know, to do this. And you're going to literally see people start losing arms and being killed and stuff like that in some of these work conditions.
You know, I went to a conference about a month ago where a lot of welfare rights activists were, and they were talking about the issue of welfare rights groups actually taking on workfare, taking on getting slots in their organizations around workfare, and they were debating whether or not to take them. On the one hand, they would be able to have people who are on welfare fighting for welfare rights. On the other hand, they'd be participating in the system.
That is a real big problem. Our organization has never taken workfare participants, but a lot of emergency food programs around the state have taken them. Last year, the governor in New York State proposed legislation that would require any nonprofit agency receiving any source of state funding to have to take workfare. And, you know, we fought that very hard and got that defeated last year, but we expect we'll see that same type of proposals again.
What other actions are you taking now as we wrap up? Is it a done deal? I mean, we're talking about welfare repeal. It's already been signed into law. Welfare is now going to the states. You got the big military contractors and other corporations going for the big contracts. What are you doing as a welfare rights activist?
Well, the fight now is at the state level. And to a certain extent, especially what used to be called the AFDC program, a general welfare program, what the federal government has done is has changed the funding formula. But it hasn't really changed the rules at the state level. The state itself will have to make the decision how it changes the rule. It may mean that if they provide certain services, that federal dollars will not support those services. But each state will have to make that determination for itself. So everybody is very much right now trying to work with the state legislatures. We in New York have a little better situation because we have a constitutional requirement to care for the needy. We're the only state in the country that has that constitutional requirement. So we at least start with a little easier playing field than, say, New Jersey or
our other states, fighting for that constitutional amendment in their state constitutions?
No. And, in fact, what's happening in New York is the state legislature wants to change that constitutional amendment. I mean, that constitutional provision is very much under assault. The other issue we haven't even talked anything about yet today is also that nonprofits can move in to take over the welfare system. And a lot of the big human service agencies, starting with like United Way, are looking at that issue. And that's another conflict of interest situation.
Well, I want to thank you very much for joining us, Mark Dunley, author of a piece in the current Covert Action Quarterly on welfare and who is it that's making the profit off of the welfare contracts going to the states.
Thank you for having us this morning.
Thanks for being with us. I also should say he is executive director of the Hunger Action Network, which is a state anti-hunger coalition that is based in Albany, New York. You're listening to Democracy Now! Up next, we're going to hear about politics online with Larry Bensky, who just attended a meeting in South San Francisco on that subject. But before that, the death penalty and a man who just got a reprieve from the U.S. Supreme Court. Stay with us. You're listening to Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. The U.S. Supreme Court yesterday postponed the execution of a man on death row in Virginia named Joseph Odell. Odell was convicted in the 1985 rape and murder strangulation of Helen Schartner. She was 44 years old. At the time of the slaying, Odell was on parole for kidnapping and robbery convictions in Florida. He says that DNA evidence can prove his innocence. Odell's case has garnered international attention, especially in Italy, where opposition to the death penalty is strong. In fact, the Pope, the Italian president, and prime minister have all urged the U.S. to grant Odell clemency. Joining us right now to talk about this issue is a man who's been following it well. He is the editor of an Italian magazine called Avvenimenti. His name is Edgardo Pellegrini, and he's based in Rome, Italy. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Okay.
Well, can you tell us how it is that Joseph Odell and his stay on death row came to your attention?
Well, you know, we have a big attention about the death penalty all through the world. It's not the first time we begin a big struggle to save someone. Last year, Italy has been one of the most important points in the world to save Mumia Boujamal. And my magazine and my radio, because I'm working both in a weekly magazine, Avvenimenti, and in a radio, a popular radio network. I was for them to Philadelphia to attend at court hearings, and I spent a couple of weeks in the North End Black Philadelphia in the house of Reverend Bevel with the son and the sister of Mumia Boujamal. And we published a book about this experience with 1,500 copies sold in Italy to save Mumia.
Tell us, in the case of Mumia Boujamal, is it true that he is the honorary mayor of both Palermo and Venice?
Speak slowly, please.
Okay, sorry.
I beg your pardon for my English.
Is it true? I beg your pardon that I can't speak Italian, but... is it true that Mumia Boujamal is the honorary mayor of Venice and Palermo?
Yes, it's true.
Well, I think this would come as a surprise to many in the United States.
But, you know, we have a very long experience of struggle against the death penalty. I think that, we have an historical experience, an historical culture about this. Probably you know that in the 80th century, Cesare Beccaria was the first Italian lawyer who wrote a book against the death penalty in 1764. Huh. But in the modern times, we have a big growth of cautions against the apartheid death penalty in South Africa. And a very strong campaign was made to save the Sharpeville Six. This was the most important campaign in the 80s in Italy to save someone. Then we had last year two campaigns, the first to save Mumia Abu Jamal, the other to save, unhappily we can't save him, Ken Saro-Wiwa, the writer of Ogoni People in Nigeria. Mm. And in the same time, we make a strong protest against Tarkei because of the massacre in the jail in Istanbul and in Ankara.
In Turkey, the Turkish prisoners.
Yes, exactly. So we are very concerned about the death penalty. We think that we are less or more 1,000 days before the third millennium, and we have a world who is a very barbaric world. And, you know, in Italy, after the Second World War, a lot of people look at American way of life. Now, a lot of people look at American way of death.
You know, that's quite an amazing way to put it, that we are 1,000 days away from the third millennium. Well, Joseph O'Dell, the man who is on Virginia death row, and he does remain on Virginia death row. It's just that he had a reprieve from being killed at 9 o'clock tonight. He would have been the ninth man executed in Virginia this year, the most of any state in the country.
I know, and in the same time is also a record for the Virginia, because before 96, never they killed a lot of people as in 96.
Mm-hmm.
And but you know, for our part, of course, if we know that an innocent is in death row, we have rage. If we know that a black or someone of a minority is in death row, we have shame. If a woman is in death row, we have horror. But this is not the point. We are against the death penalty at all.
Well, you know, in this case of Joseph O'Dell, we learned that the Pope John Paul II heard about the case from an advertisement placed in Italy by the human rights group Amnesty International, but that O'Dell's attorneys are arguing that jurors in his 1986 trial were not told that he could have been sentenced to life without parole, an omission the Supreme Court later deemed unconstitutional in another case. As many as 100 other inmates sentenced under similar circumstances could be affected if the U.S. Supreme Court decides to hear the appeal. Those are 100 other prisoners on death row around the country whose juries were not told that instead of the death penalty, the person convicted could have gotten life without parole. What is the system in Italy?
Well, we have no death penalty, of course. And also the life terms penalty is not a life terms because it can be more than 30 years. And
so no one can be sentenced. No one can be sentenced to more than 30 years.
You can stay in jail 30 years, no one day more.
Hmm.
And this moment, we have a big discussion, lawyers, judges, theoricals, academics, about the opportunity. to resolve the problem of penalty without jail. And this is a very important and theoretical discussion. And the problem is, what is the way to recuperate to the life and to the society people who was against the law?
Mm-hmm. Well, let me ask you something as we wrap up, Edgardo Pellegrini, about the role of the World Wide Web in the case of Joseph O'Dell.
I think it is important because, you know, in Italy, first of all, was an attorney, now he is a member of parliament, who was in the States and speaking with a colleague of Virginia, knew the case of O'Dell. And this attorney put the problem in the parliament. And in a couple of days, he collected 130 signatures of members of parliament against the death of O'Dell. And he passed to our magazine the list of signatures, but there were very few news about O'Dell. So I take the web, the World Wide Web, and I look for O'Dell. I met a page, a O'Dell page, and with a lot of articles. And in the same times, I look for some newspaper of Virginia, and I met the Virginian Pilot. So every day I were reading the Virginian Pilot about the case.
Huh. Well, do you by
and
any...
I think that Avvenimenti and Radio Popolare was the media who impulsed the campaign. But we have our editor, Claudio Fracassi, who was for a week reading the newspapers in the national public radio. The national public radio in Italy is very, very listened. And this program is 7 o'clock in the morning, have every week a different editor of an Italian magazine reading the newspapers. And for a week, our editor began No One News in the international press about O'Dell. And this is a problem very, very important. I think that this use of the broadcasting the problem of O'Dell was the key to develop the movement in Italy.
Well, Edgardo Pellegrini, I want to thank you very much for joining us. And I dare say that there are probably more people in Italy than in the United States who know about the case of Joseph O'Dell. Edgardo Pellegrini, editor of Avvenimenti, which is a weekly magazine in Rome, Italy. I want to thank you very much for joining us. And speaking about the World Wide Web, and by the way, you can probably just put Joseph O'Dell's name in any search engine and you can find his website as well as articles about him. We're now going to turn to overall the issue of online politics. Using email and the World Wide Web has begun to be seen as an alternative means of communicating political information. Many questions remain, however, about how online politics has developed, where it's heading, and most of all, who will control it. Well, there was a conference to discuss these and other issues concerning online politics last week in South San Francisco, and Pacifica's national affairs correspondent Larry Bensky was there.
One of the first questions that comes to mind about politics online is who, if anyone interested in politics, is online, and what use are those online making of the various services available? Dr. Bruce Bimber teaches political science at the University of California at Santa Barbara. He specializes in analyzing the audience for online services.
Well, it turns out there are a number of definitions of what constitutes a regular user, but the figure right now is probably in the ballpark of 10 to 15% of adults in the United States. My own numbers suggest that the number of people who use the net at least once a week is around 10 or 11%. If you include those people who use the net a few times a month or more, let's say two or three times a month or more frequently, the number goes up to around 15%. And if you expand the definition to include people who've used the net at all in the last 3 months or 6 months, the number goes up. But I want you to get a sense of the rough ratio between the number of people who have access and the number of people who use the net on a reasonably regular basis. And in this figure, I mean using any aspect of the net, whether it's email or the web or FTP. People on the net are probably more politically active than the U.S. as a whole. That's to say, that 26%, the people I just described to you, appear to be registered to vote at higher rates than do Americans as a whole. They appear to vote more frequently than do Americans as a whole. They appear to be more engaged in other kinds of activities, political activities, like attending rallies, signing petitions, and so on, than do Americans as a whole. Now, the question comes up, has the net drawn people into politics and encouraged them to participate? Or has the net merely attracted those people who are already engaged in politics and given them a new medium? That's to say, do we have a new audience and a new medium, or do we just have a new medium? The answer is we don't know yet. But if you take a comparable demographic for the United States as a whole, that's to say people who look like people with a college degree, a reasonably high household income, you find that their voter registration rates and voter participation rates and their engagement in other kinds of politics appear to be just about the same as what is being measured for people who use the net. So far, there's no interesting finding here that we're getting an increase in participation. But these findings, again, are only suggestive. So to summarize this, on political characteristics, the net is probably not too far from the mainstream. There's no evidence yet to suggest it's attracting a new audience to politics, although that really is an open question. There are some differences in participation rates and in ideology and so on. These may or may not simply be accounted for by the demographic characteristic, that's the demographic group that's using the net. On the other hand, on socioeconomic characteristics, the net is decidedly not mainstream. The net is a place for people who are more likely to have a college degree and who have higher income. In that sense, the net's not a cross-section of the public yet. While survey researchers disagree about some of the numbers I've just given you, whether the number's 26 or 22 or 28, for instance, one thing does seem clear, and that is that all these demographics are changing quite rapidly. Access has expanded dramatically. The net has become a more diverse place. It's begun to look a little bit more like the U.S. as a whole. So that should lead you to an obvious question, and that is, how long will this growth and diversification of the net continue? That's really where the action is. How long can we expect to see the growth in total net access and the diversification of the net that's happened in the last few years continue? If those rates were to continue, it wouldn't take too long for the net to look more and more like the U.S. as a whole. That is, by the way, precisely what happened with some other technologies. Television, for instance, which started out as a very expensive technology in the late 1940s, took just 3 decades to reach 97 or 98% of households, and it did so with an extraordinary socioeconomic diversity. That's to say, there isn't much socioeconomic bias. In fact, there's a little bit of an inverse bias in who owns television sets. Telephones, on the other hand, took 6 or 7 decades to get into 95% of households, and there still is a strong socioeconomic bias in telephone ownership. That's to say, those people at the lower end of the socioeconomic scale are much less likely to have a telephone than those above. So what's the net going to look like? TV, telephone, something else? There are some reasons to think that the growth of the net will begin to slow down. Those have to do with cost. They have to do with a slowdown in first-time personal computer purchases for the home and so on. There are some indicators that suggest that maybe that growth has already begun to slow, but it's really a little bit too soon to tell. So I want to leave you with that final idea. A, caution, and B, a question, and that is, where are these rates of change headed in the net?
Dr. Bruce Bimber of UC Santa Barbara. With approximately 26 million people in this country at least occasionally using online communication, there's a great deal of speculation about who they are and how they use those services. Peter Grunwald is a media consultant who works closely with the New York media survey organization Find SVP. Grunwald says there's a lot of myth about who uses online communications and how.
Because of these numbers, there's just an extraordinary amount of hype about the net and about the web. that a lot of which kind of revolves around the notion that it's a mass medium and that it is going to attract viewers and users from among this sort of throng of millions of surfers on the net. And because of that, you have a lot of traditional advertising agency and other folks who are trying to impose a sort of archaic model on advertising and on communications, information dissemination over the net, which essentially looks at just raw numbers, the raw number of eyeballs that you've got glued to your computer screen, similarly to the number of eyeballs you've got watching television. And I'm going to suggest that, in fact, that is an inappropriate model and that there may be more appropriate ways of thinking about this stuff and actually playing with it. Another myth that's out there is that net users somehow represent a unique group of people from a political standpoint, that their views are out on the fringe, that they are in some ways, in some important ways, truly weird compared to the general population. And although that may be the case in some ways, it's not really in terms of their political views and social views, and we'll try to get at some of that. First thing I want to take a look at, in fact, is the notion of the web as at least a traditional mass medium publishing, a traditional mass market medium. In fact, I don't believe that it is. Very quickly here, what we see is that most users of the web, according to FindSVP, take a look at only a few sites in any detail past the first couple of levels, so that you're not going to get a lot of people hitting your site through serendipity, which is the basic myth surrounding a CPM model. I won't go into the actual numbers, but I'll just mention that when you get past the first level in a lot of websites, you have enormous fall off in terms of the number of people who look at your site. In terms of political involvement, as may have been mentioned earlier today, the GBU survey showed that there's a much higher proportion of political involvement on the part of web users than the general population. There's a higher level of interest in online activities. And interestingly enough, this is particularly so among women and self-employed people. We also found that there's an extraordinary correlation between how politically active people are and how commercially active, that is, how the extent to which they're likely to be active purchasers. You also see, in terms of political views here, that essentially there's a clustering around the middle. Web users, according to their political beliefs, are not super weird. Maybe there's a slight lean towards the progressive side of the spectrum, but generally they track the general population. In terms of the final sort of graph I want to show you, we found in FindSVP's research that that internet use in a household threatens television to the greatest extent in terms of contention for people's time. You see here in this graph that there's an enormous fall off. 32% of the homes that have internet told FindSVP that their television watching has gone down.
Peter Grunwald. You're listening to a special report on the recent Politics Online conference held in South San Francisco, California. This is Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back with more on this conference in 60 seconds. This is Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Larry Bensky. The Politics Online conference was a day-long event with 30 panelists addressing 8 different aspects of the electronic communications phenomena. Among the topics discussed was the content of this year's electoral communications and how various candidates tried to reach various constituencies online. Although there was general agreement that this year the net and the web were serious factors in only a few isolated races, there was also general consensus that in the coming years, more politicians will be tempted to use the growing medium. But there is already a tendency, which was discussed by Associated Press internet writer Elizabeth Weiss, to filter political communications so that the online audience, as in much other material presented during elections, will hear only what politicians think they want to hear.
I think there's a lot of hype out on the net as to what this will be for politics, and it is my sense that much of that is not coming true. I think of most concern, and it wasn't this election, but many of the people that I spoke to said that they're concerned about it in 4 years, is the notion of filtering. I mean, the whole thing about the web has been that it allows, I mean, everybody's so happy, it allows everyone to leapfrog over the media. And no longer do we serve as gatekeepers to information, which is probably good in some ways. But on the other hand, it is becoming easier if, you know, say you're the Clinton website or the Dole website, and I go to your website and look around and I look at welfare reform and Social Security. The next time I go there, it is entirely possible to do. And in fact, several people off record at both of those sites told me that they hope to do it the next time around. Well, that when you come to that site the next time, it will write itself to what you specifically are interested. So when you come back, it will look like the only thing that this candidate cares about is welfare reform and Social Security. And, you know, I mean, which is exactly what a candidate would do on a stump speech or speaking to a specific group. But it's interesting, people probably are not realizing that degree of filtering is possible.
Associated Press internet writer Elizabeth Weiss. Another thing that people probably aren't realizing is that online political communication is very much an in-crowd matter this far. As far as who listens to it, the audience at the Politics Online conference was reminded by San Jose Mercury News reporter Holly Heiser that it's very limited demographically.
I think the biggest obstacle to all of us in terms of increasing civic involvement or anything we're talking here about politics online is look around you here right now and you'll see what this audience is like. I mean, you know, you saw the statistics up there earlier and y'all are pretty white and pretty educated, and there's a whole lot of other people we need to bring into this. And until we bring everyone in, we're not really going to do a whole lot. We're going to keep talking. We're going to keep preaching to this converted crowd. And that's, our biggest obstacle. The technology will come. We just need to make sure it goes to everyone.
Of continuing concern throughout the electoral world, and this was true at the Politics Online conference as well, is the low rate of participation in the electoral system, with this year's turnout one of the lowest in history for a presidential election. Here again, the online world has been presented as something of a potential panacea, with electronic voter registration and perhaps eventually electronic voting presented as possibilities. But those who run the electoral system, like California's Secretary of State Bill Jones, are wary of the online solutions presently being proposed.
I think the potential is that we can go toward digital signature to get your verification, tighten that process up so that we have good confidence level on the voter fraud issue, and you can make that hopefully go away. You tighten down the registration so you don't have bounty hunters out there who are putting fraudulent registrations together, which is a problem we have. It's because it's just like anything else. If you have good information coming in the front end, then your process is good. If you have bad information, it's bad. And if we do that, then we can use the digital signature as a real unique verification tool to tighten down the system. Then you can do things like vote by mail. You can do things like computer vote. You can do some of those things, but you got to have security first, and you got to have the technology to do it. And I think some of those opportunities are coming along with new technology, but they're not quite here yet.
California Secretary of State Bill Jones. So just exactly what can the online world offer the political world? One phrase continually thrown around in discussions of the online phenomenon is the so-called virtual community. But with the technology for the moment being faceless and each individual online being hidden behind his or her computer screen, what kind of community can be created? That issue was discussed by two panelists at the Politics Online conference, Todd Lappin, a senior editor at Wired Magazine, and Peter Grunewald, once again, of Grunewald Associates.
Just one little connecting thread which sort of runs through a lot of things that have said. Peter was just talking about creating communities that people trust. What you really want to do when you're organizing using this new media is you're ultimately creating communities of interest. That's sort of a real important idea to bear in mind. I mean, we said this is a direct marketing medium, this is a niche medium. What you're really doing is creating a community of some sort around a common interest. And that's really something you want to bear in mind no matter what you're doing using the medium, is that you are trying to engage a community and build it around the issues that are of concern to you.
If I can just stick one thought to even reinforce that, I absolutely agree, and in fact, I talk about the C's. I think that the mistake that a lot of people in that are using is they're forgetting that it is much more powerful not as a medium of delivering stuff at people, but of engaging people and getting and offering them communications, collaboration, connectivity, community, as opposed to just throwing stuff at them. And that's the mistake that a lot of the big publishing firms, the Time Warners, are making right now.
A number of organizations active in the political arena were represented at the Politics Online conference, including Rock the Vote, a $2 million a year operation funded by the music industry. This year, Rock the Vote says it mobilized 500,000 young people to register and vote. Jessica Tully is one of Rock the Vote's 9 employees. She created and maintains Rock the Vote's website.
These days, we are definitely moving to a place where we're engaging much broader audiences. We were just talking about our hip-hop coalition and really engaging hip-hop artists and different folks in the urban communities to use the words that are very political if you listen to, you know, hip-hop music and rap music, engaging audiences of the least participation. So it's really working with artists who have a huge audience, but invoking sort of political themes and getting them to help people really bridge the gap and get involved in the political system by registering to vote at the very, you know, just the basic level things. Register on time and know where your polling place is and getting your ass to the polls when election day comes.
A lot of young people didn't get their asses to the polls this election day, and they haven't for quite a few election days. What's going on?
Yeah, a lot of people, not just young people, a lot of people decided to stay home this year.
But the participation of 18 to 24s is particularly low compared to the demographics in the population. Why?
People are not engaged by, you know, the politicians never speak to young people. All young people hear is no loitering, curfews, no, you know, graffiti, no...
No skateboard.
No skateboarding is a very big issue. So, you know, our audiences are hearing a lot of no. And so, of course, they stay home when they're told, like, you're just a slacker, you're just, you don't count. But that's why we're here, to say, oh, yes, you count, and the things that are affect your everyday lives are political things. And that's why, you know, get the knowledge, get information about the issues that are affecting your life, and go to the polls and vote. And it's, you know, difficult to talk about it as an individual thing, and that doesn't work. It's a team sport, and people need to collectively know the issues that are, you know, coming up in legislature, and keep your eyes on your public officials. They work for you.
Well, there's a lot of young people who spend a lot of time online, if we get correct statistics. That doesn't seem to translate in their case into greater participation in the electoral politics system. What does the web need to do? What does email need to do? What does this whole Politics Online conference need to do to get more young people involved?
Be relevant. Be relevant. Know the young people's lives, you know, and reach out to them and let them know that when you're going to a clinic and there are folks outside the clinic trying to discourage you, well, that's political. And you have, you know, every right to decide, you know, if that's going to be, you know, something that you want to allow, or, you know, vote and make your voice heard to say, no, you know, I'm going to elect officials that perhaps are going to, you know, protect my right to go to a clinic, or, you know, engage in, you know, an evening out in any way that I see fit. Whether, you know, there's a lot of, you know, the police have really bumped up their, you know, patrols and, you know, questioning people when they're just going out. Rock the Vote, we're in Los Angeles. And, you know, if you just any evening go out to, you know, the Hollywood area, it's a police state.
Especially if you're black.
Especially if you're black. And if you're black or Latino or, you know, in any kind of way suspect, you're asked to get out of your car and explain yourself. Well, that's not democracy. And we try to engage people and let them know that you've got a choice. And you can, you know, if you get out there and let people know and let the legislators know that you're watching them, then they're going to start, you know, really paying attention and making decisions that are in your best interest as well.
This conference doesn't look like America, as they say. If there was a person of color in the 100 people in the room, I didn't see him or her. Why do you think this is?
I think it has to do with outreach and how much it costs to get to these conferences. It's, you know, a lot of times this is too much money to pay to, you know, get the information. And I think, you know, people are just taken for granted, like, oh, poor communities, people of color, you're not online. Well, actually, that's where I got my start in Brooklyn. New York was a small BBS service called New York Online, which looks a lot more like America than this conference. But that's okay, because a lot of these professionals, they need to know.
Continue with that. I was trying to ask you why there weren't more people of color here. And it isn't only an economic thing. There are plenty of middle class black kids and Latino kids. They're not here. Why?
I think it's a question of outreach, and I would, you know, really encourage folks when they're putting on conferences to do much better outreach, because I think the internet, and why I'm here and why I do any of this, is because it is a tool that can be used by all of us. And I think that with conferences like that, you know, get more people, do more outreach, and the panels that also need to be a lot more diverse. There are plenty of folks who are up online and, you know, have, you know, virtual varios, and we all have plenty to learn from all of that. And you know, there's, especially in the Bay Area, there's an opportunity to really have some cross-cultural exchange. When you're online, you don't know if I'm black, white, female, male, Latino, straight, gay, and that's great, because it's all just a question of information and exchange, and that's why I do what I do. And our 800 number is 1-800-CALL-RTV. And in the next, you know, post-election, let the games begin. This is when the games begin. This is when we are watching now these elected officials and letting them know, well, you know what? You're not representing me. Or, you know what? You're doing a great job. And, you know, especially with the Electronic Decency Act, it's coming up in the Supreme Court.
Jessica Tully of Rock the Vote. Their 800 number, once again, is 1-800-CALL-RTV. And no report on a topic like politics online would be complete without providing you with some websites, which we'll do in a minute. So get ready to write down a few online addresses if you're interested. But first, a personal word from this reporter who's followed the development of politics on the web very closely this year, because working for a personnel-starved organization like Pacifica, you can be sure that we try as hard as we can to get accurate information with a minimum of time spent getting it. There's no question in my mind that the web is a valuable and a growing asset, both for one-way communication of information and for the development of interactive relations. But it also can't be forgotten that the act of using a computer is almost always an individual and isolating one, and that for a responsible journalist, there's a major difference between raw data and communicable information. So on the one hand, what one gets via email or through various online sites can be intriguing, and it can be gotten fast, and it can lead to other sites with more intriguing and more rapid data. But that doesn't mean it's necessarily true or that it leads to an increase in knowledge, much less wisdom, which is what media at its best is all about. Even if every word ever written in every language becomes available and instantly cross-referenced on a chip no bigger than a fingernail, there'll still have to be an organizing brain or brains to make sense of it all and to give it context. As for the construction of virtual communities, there's a vast difference between such ethereal entities and political organization. Sharing data, sharing emotions, sharing stories, sharing whatever online is good, but sharing human space will always be better. Which is why so much in human transactions, be they political, commercial, sexual, whatever, has always been organized around the simple technique of just looking someone right in the eye. A good deal of television's falsity comes from the erroneous presupposition that having someone stare at you without your being able to see them is sufficiently effective to guarantee sincerity. It isn't, and it never will be. So no matter how many whistles, gongs, and bells the online world is able to develop, and with MPEGs and caches and hypertexts, it gets more impressive all the time, there'll still be a necessary element for effective human interaction missing, which will always require body and face time, as does effective political community. And now for those websites. The best conventional electoral politics one is www.politicsnow.com. Politics Now is spelled as one word, www.politicsnow.com. A good source of information about public policy debates is www.policy.com. and for various forms of grassroots organizing and use of the online world for alternative approaches to politics, try www.netaction.org. That's NetAction spelled as one word, www.netaction.org.
Thank you very much for that report, Larry. Larry Bensky, our national affairs correspondent. And I'm Amy Goodman for Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!